Ladies and gentlemen, Madame et Messieurs, on peut continuer.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to reopen our session at this point. And we're now going to talk about future challenges of the European Union.
Experts, they will introduce our debate. They all have maximum 10 minutes, so they have to be short and to the point. The first speaker I can introduce is Dominique Riquet. He's the Vice Chair of the Committee of Transport and Tourism at the European Parliament. And I would like to give him the floor. And after him, it will be Matthias Reuter who will speak to us. And finally, we have a third speaker, and that's Yvonne Schlingenberg. So, but we start with Dominique.
Thank you, Bart. 10 minutes, on va essayer de...
10 minutes, well, that's not much. I'll try to be concise. What are the challenges for Europe? Well, there are so many of them that it's difficult to categorize them. To link this into the previous debate, which was very interesting indeed, with lots of ideas. I mean, there's a semantic challenge, in fact, a challenge concerning the words, because the relationship to Europe of citizens is a relationship that needs to be redefined. We have seen that with this grand march toward Europe, there was the door-to-door contact. But finally, in the ultimate analysis, in fact, citizens either accept or don't accept the European Union. But then there's also a division between those who like and those who don't like the European Union. And in the relationship of citizens to Europe, well, it's not always a relationship that is rational. There is this emotion. I mean, I like it or I don't like it. It's not just being in favor or not in favor. So this can be positive or negative, and this really is in conflict with this concept of an EU citizenship. And now the other semantic challenge that we have is this mix-up between Europe and the European Union. Europe is a concept that appeals to sentiment, to love, to history, to culture, to geography, to roots, whereas the European Union is a political and administrative entity defined by treaties. And it's clear that the European Union doesn't sound as good in slogan or emotional terms than the term Europe. So the European Union really needs to gain more in terms of powers relating to social policies, tax policies, foreign policy, justice, defense. But if you try to get around the problem of the treaties which limit what the EU can do, you nevertheless try to work on these subjects. The minister has told us about an incipient European defense policy, but institutionally the EU is not provided with those powers. But there is nevertheless an attempt to sort of get around the treaties. So, if you accept that Europe and the European Union need to be perceived differently, then that would mean that the EU needs to be provided with the powers to manage the policies that it should, if it is to be Europe. I mean, the Eurosceptics are saying that the Union cannot fulfill its mission. But in fact, the mission was never entrusted to it in the first place, in many cases. So the institutional powers that have been provided to the EU, unfortunately based on treaties, and the treaties have become a Golgotha for politicians, and so no government really wants to move forward. So there is an institutional obstruction to the change in the treaties to provide the EU with the tasks that it should be taking up. Now, there are other challenges, but I know that my time is limited, but there are some other praiseworthy challenges or missions, new missions relating to safety, security, defense, protecting Europeans against terrorism, harmonizing the judiciaries, dealing appropriately with migration, asylum, border control. And that really is based on the challenge of globalization. And here the institutional tools have been provided to the EU. It has had a lot of difficulties because of subsidiarity to really deal with these challenges head on. There is a European space policy. There is a European research policy. There is a beginning to be a European digital policy or a European digital space. But ultimately, the institutional challenge that I've referred to already conditions the way in which politically or operationally the EU responds to certain challenges. So when it can do something, when it has the means to do something, it does something, not always perfectly, but it does. When it doesn't have the institutional prerogatives to do it, such as in defense, it does what it can. And when it doesn't have any possibility whatsoever, then it doesn't act. So really what we need to do is to give the institutions of the EU the means to implement a European project, a European vision. And Europe sort of moves forward in fits and starts. Crises push it forward. In 2008, the EU started to deal with financial and economic issues. There still is obstruction when it comes to Europe-wide capital markets or financial markets or Europe-wide banking supervisory system. But I really hope that we won't have to wait much longer to see this work even better. Thank you.
Thank you, Dominique, for your intervention. Now I would like to give the floor to Matthias Reuter. He is Director General for Migration at the European Commission. So you have the floor.
Merci beaucoup, Mr. Sommer.
Thank you very much. In fact, I was Director General for Security and Internal Affairs and Migration until a few months ago, but now I am an advisor to the President of the Commission. So all questions that you may wish to put on migration can be put to me. I am here to answer them or not to answer them. But perhaps I can introduce the subject by stepping back a bit from things. I mean, we all say that we're looking for a new narrative for Europe. Now, if we look at the narratives that we've had through the succession of treaties for the European Union, the first narrative was never more war. Then there was prosperity and free circulation for all persons. The third narrative was a single currency. The fourth narrative, and I'm sure that you'll talk about that, is the climate, is combating climate change. And now we're looking for yet another narrative. And what really strikes me in the speeches of President Macron is that there is this narrative of European sovereignty. not a single or an unique sovereignty. You explained quite well in the previous discussion that it's more a question of a marriage among different levels of sovereignty. But we need to develop this concept of a European sovereignty, which would perhaps be based on issues like climate, like full control of migration policy, of investments in the future, be it in research or artificial intelligence, infrastructure, on which we've worked together a lot with Dominique, or security and defense. But if we don't manage to come up with this new narrative, then I think we will lose the battle for the minds and hearts of citizens. My experience in the migration area over the last 4 years was that we were confronted with a crisis. It was a huge Europe-wide crisis. And we didn't really have the instruments needed to deal with this crisis. I arrived as Director General for Migration and Internal Affairs in 2014. The crisis started in 2015. And in 2015, everyone looked at the European Union and they said, ah, what is Europe doing? You don't guard or control our external borders. You have an asylum system that doesn't work. It's ineffective, etc., etc. But the reality was that our member states were much too sovereign at the national level. Frontex is an agency with a staff of 200 people in Warsaw. I love Warsaw, but this is not the external border of the European Union. I mean, with 200 people, you can protect the Senate, the French Senate, and not the European Union. And similarly, with the asylum agency, 70 people in Malta. And during this crisis, and I think that the young colleague who was here who answered a question about migration described it very well. In fact, the ministers of internal affairs kept migration as something reserved to them at the national level until such time as it no longer worked at the national level. And they turned to Europe and they said, what are you doing? So what did we do? Well, in reality, during this crisis, we did quite a few things to create solidarity, to put in place appropriate structures. We made a proposal for a border control force, which was negotiated in record time with the European Parliament, which supported it very strongly. And now in the financial perspective, we're talking about creating a force of 10,000 officers. We'll see how far that goes. And we are also in the process, for the first time, of developing a European policy for Africa. I mean, hitherto there was a French policy for Africa, a German policy for Africa to some extent, a Belgian one, a Dutch policy for Africa, an Italian policy for Africa, but there was no real joint, commonly shared policy for Africa of the European Union, and that is being developed, has been developed. And we developed a number of other systems for the purpose of better protecting our external borders. We made a proposal, which is a bit of a dead letter for the time being, about the right of asylum, and I'm sure questions will be put about that. It's not working very well. But we did manage, during the storm of the migration crisis, to build, to put in place these new instruments. You mentioned the banking crisis. And yes, it's true. It's very often during a crisis or in the face of a crisis that EU starts to starts to develop, it starts to become operational, because it becomes obvious that the individual national policy approach is insufficient. And that leaves me very optimistic after 32 years of working for the Commission. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. In fact, it's two times nearly the same message, but it's a message of hope, because in crises, Europe can reform and can integrate. But at the same time, it's a very dangerous concept, because you have to be capable of finding solutions in the midst of a crisis all the time. So it can also go the wrong way. So that's very dangerous. Eh? So the third speaker, Yvonne Slingenberg, she's director of the DG Climate. She will also tell us a little bit, introduce us to another item that has to do with the new challenges of Europe. Please, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Somers. Bonjour, moi j'ai préparé, je me suis préparé en français.
I prepared to speak in French, so I'll make my presentation in French. As to the challenges and opportunities in the area of energy and climate, well, we are confronted with the most significant transformation of our energy systems since the Industrial Revolution. I mean, that's very significant. And this transformation must be perceived as an opportunity and not just a constraint, which is sometimes the case. The objective of the European Union is to set up favorable conditions to support this transformation, to modernize our energy system, our industry, in fact, our entire economy needs to be transformed. The EU must be a driving force and must be exemplary on the international arena, respecting its commitments at the end of 2015 taken up under the Paris Agreement. We also need favorable conditions for growing ambition of the national commitments. The Paris Agreement provides for that, and then we can align ourselves with the overall long-term objectives of the Paris Agreement, namely to keep the overall temperature rise of the planet to less than 2 degrees centigrade. The European Union played a key role in the development and the deployment of clean technologies. It has also chosen the way to achieve energy efficiency in building and transport and many other areas. And our industries have gained a competitive advantage in a number of sectors where there is more and more worldwide competition. Our researchers, our engineers, our technicians are really are at the cutting edge. We have decided on a number of regulatory changes which really support our objective to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 40% between now and 2030. The system of emissions quotas for industry and other sectors, an agreement on the sharing of efforts among member states in other sectors, building, transport, agriculture, etc., and also more recently the regulation on taking into consideration carbon capture in soils and forests. And these efforts must send a signal to the European economies that emissions must be reduced in industry. And with the emissions quotas, we have taken advantage of the money flowing in to set up a fund to assist various industrial sectors in achieving the energy transformation. Over the last year and a half, the Commission presented a number of proposals for clean energy, the circular economy, for clean mobility. These proposals are before the Council and the Parliament, and we hope that there will be an agreement, in fact, over the next few weeks before the end of the Bulgarian presidency on these packages. The measures in energy concern energy saving, renewable energy, and the use of electricity for transport. So a whole series of packages with a reform of the energy market as a whole. Now, this, of course, takes into consideration the issue of energy security and supply, but also the energy vulnerability of traditional coal-fired plants, for instance, and disadvantaged peoples. And it is essential that one takes into consideration the negative impact that there can be when you move to a low-carbon economy. That will necessarily disadvantage some individuals. Insofar as clean energy, lighter vehicles, and stricter CO2 emission standards for heavier vehicles, something we'd never done in Europe previously in the package. Already includes other measures, the development of zero-emission vehicles, a significant initiative on electricity batteries. It's important that we produce them in Europe and not be completely dependent on China, which produces those batteries at the present time. Also, of course, multimodal transport. Another interesting aspect is that we are also making progress on so-called sustainable financing on European capital markets in order to make it possible to reorient capital investment into our climate protection objectives. We believe that 180 billion euros, additional billion euros, need to be invested every year over the next 5 years in order to achieve our objectives. That's 3% of capital formation on European capital markets, which is significant but not insurmountable. And we also need to use the public resources in a more strategic manner. It was mentioned already this morning that in our financial framework that we are proposing for the period 2021-2027, the European Commission has suggested that the share of the European budget that is to contribute to climate action is to be increased to 25%. That would be 320 billion euros. And with those public resources of the Commission budget, we could also take advantage of leverage and attract more capital from elsewhere. We have also mobilized more or less 3 billion euros extra for 2018-2019 in the field of research, because it's important to speed up research on climate change. There is also the adaptation strategy for Europe to climate change adopted in 2013. It's being implemented, and we have not yet decided whether for the new Commission will be proposing a new strategy. Because even if you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, unfortunately, the consequences of climate change are already present, and we must be present and prepared to adapt to that at the local, regional, and national levels. We're also preparing for a new long-term energy strategy, and the European Commission is going to propose a so-called vision paper to the European Parliament and Member States between now and the end of the year before the next climate conference to be held in Katowice in Poland at the end of this year. And with this long-term vision, we do intend to propose a clean economy with very limited GHG emissions. So we are well positioned to give a model example to the rest of the world. It's not the European Union that's moving forward all alone. China, India, and other countries are investing massively in the transition to a low-carbon economy. So it is a challenge for us to move more quickly than they do in order to be well positioned in the sector of clean economies. To give you a sense of the international situation, this year is a crucial year. I've already mentioned the climate conference to be held in Katowice in Poland at the end of the year. And there the rules for the functioning of the Paris Agreement are to be agreed. The Paris Agreement was reached, it was signed, but there are implementation rules as to how commitments made are to be monitored. There is also a multilateral effort to reduce emissions that is called the Tanawa Dialogue. Tanawa is in Fiji. It will be one of the first concrete outcomes of the Paris Agreement of 2015. Now, we know, of course, that the United States have announced that they will be withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, but we don't expect things to change. President Trump still intends to withdraw from the agreement unless more favorable conditions can be negotiated, but he doesn't really expect the Paris Agreement to be renegotiated, and he's not apparently prepared to make new commitments. Now, of course, we're disappointed, but since the announcement of President Trump about a year ago, the international community has overcome that shock, and the Paris Agreement has, in fact, come out of that storm grander and greater than it was. The other G20 countries, representing 90% of GHG emissions around the planet, all 19 of them, other than the United States, have committed themselves at the Hamburg Summit of last year to make sure that the Paris Agreement is fully implemented. In the last few months, we've seen more progress in the climate policies of large economies than ever before, and that's encouraging. The world really needs to pay attention to the progress and to forget about the dissidence of the American administration. For to achieve our objectives for the climate, we must achieve more solidarity with the poorest and the most vulnerable countries in the world. I'm just looking for the last page of my statement. Between now and the climate summit at the end of the year, the calendar of meetings is quite busy. Next week we have a ministerial with China and Canada on climate. Then we will have a world summit with non-state actors in San Francisco, organized by the state of California. Very interesting that they're organizing that in the United States. Then on the margin of the General Assembly of the United Nations at the end of September, there will be a special week on climate with a meeting to follow up on the One Planet Summit, which was convened by President Macron together with Mr. Bloomberg. And very important, in the middle of October, there will be a publication of the Intergovernmental Group of Experts on the Climate. Their report will come out. Can we, in fact, bring it down not to 2 degrees, but 1.5 degrees, 1.5 degrees? And then in Buenos Aires, there will also be a meeting that will set the tone before the climate summit in Poland. Now, on the climate, like for other subjects, we are very much in favor of the multilateral approach. We believe that to achieve our common objectives, all countries of the world need to work together. And the European Union has shown itself to be ahead of the game, to be a real leader, given the objectives that we have set ourselves, and we are well positioned on the political chessboard. It is not enough to be a champion of the world. You need to be involved in shared leadership and to bring others along with you. And we want to have more and more European cohesion and cohesion with partners outside Europe to make sure that the Paris Agreement is fully implemented and enforced. So we need to give a new impetus to this effort in Europe to achieve a transformation to a low-carbon economy with more green jobs and clean energy. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, before I give the floor to the to you, I would like also to welcome Senator Catherine Fournier from Calais. And everybody knows the challenges of Calais towards the migration issue. So I think it's proper to give her also the floor to give some comments on the migration issue. Madame la Sénateur.
Je vous remercie.
Thank you. Dear members of the Senate, no problem. The main point is that we have the opportunity to express our thoughts. Thank you for giving me the floor. Welcome here in the Senate. I belong to the center group in the Senate. I'm a member of the Senate for the Pas-de-Calais. I live in Fréthun, which is a commune that has some of the Eurotunnel infrastructure and the Eurostar railway station. I was the mayor of this commune for 22 years, so I've experienced the migration flows in the years in the early 2000 up to 2014. But we have an area which is in the north of Europe, because we are 1 hour from Brussels. 1.5 hours from Paris, and Calais is the main passenger port of Europe. So consequences on our area, of course, the migration, the phenomenon of migrations, and you are familiar with that. There's hope because on Friday, with the prefect, we went to inaugurate a new natural site that covers the former jungle of Calais that had up to 10,000 migrants on its soil. We are facing the UK, and of course, there will be the consequences of Brexit and the impact on our local economy. We have seen this year how difficult it was, and it was true in the year 2000 as well, how things were difficult because we were one of the areas that paid the heaviest price for migration. So I wrote several times to the MEPs, to the French members of Parliament, because we had the feeling that we were forgotten, you know, in the north of France, although the phenomenon was well known. And people had probably the feeling it was all under control. But our population was paying a heavy price, was suffering, and we felt we couldn't leave the migrants in their terrible situation, dire situation. What about the Brexit now? These may be the first questions. Well, I have my neighbors here that could answer that. But about immigration. The question is, what will be the European policy? Will we have Schengen borders? That will be designed in order to secure the European area? And my second question is, well, we know it's being developed at the moment, but given Brexit, what will be the vision, your vision, of how to deal with the Brexit case? Because, in fact, we're the neighbors of the British. We've always worked with Britain. This will have consequences, for example, for customs. Just to give you an example, for Eurotunnel, just Eurotunnel, I'm not talking about the harbor. It's 140 billion euro a year in income, in turnover. Can you imagine such an order of magnitude? And what unites population is love. And when you love someone, you try to help them. You help them find solutions. And we try to provide support, help with the ideas, and bring something. I want my citizens to love Europe because in our area, in the second round of the presidentials, 52% of the voters voted for the Front National, the National Front. That is unacceptable. Thank you.
Do you want to react immediately, or do we first maybe a reaction, and then we can give the floor?
Yeah, okay, it's good.
Thank you, dear member of the Senate. Thank you for your question. I think that you have to make a distinction between three things, and I think you were right. Calais and Brexit, and the whole issue of belonging to the customs union, what sort of checks and inspections and controls on the borders. We're in the midst of a negotiation on the customs issues. Mr. Barnier has just answered the offer made by the UK. At the moment, we're focusing on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But in fact, this is the same issue or the same debate we should have for other territories of the European Union. So I can't give you an answer now, but it's a major concern. The second question is linked to the external borders. At present, we are dealing with Brexit. And the first thing is, will we ask for visas from the British population? Probably not, but that has to be solved. Second question is, what about the free movement between the European Union and the UK? You know, we have the Schengen rules that to some extent recommend 90 days in a member state without a residence permit. Now, if we don't have a residence permit, we should leave the territory and only come back 90 days later, which raises a lot of issues, of course. And in the withdrawal agreement, we've negotiated some rules that, in fact, are grandfathering rules. And that is a problem. Third issue, or third question, it brings us back to Sangat and other things. How do we implement the rules? And the return and readmission policy, do we renegotiate that? This is all still in the open. I won't tell you about our negotiation strategy, but all these questions are very concrete and will have a major impact on the area of the Nord-Pas-de-Calais, but other parts of the European Union as well, if we can't solve them by, let's say, October this year. This is the challenge that we are facing at the moment. That's all I can say. Yes, of course, I feel concerned by your questions. Sébastien represented a European constituency. I went to Calais several times with different people because, of course, that was very close to my heart. There are several things. There's the whole issue of immigration and the asylum, and then borders, and then the free movement of goods, services, and people. But there's something that's always struck me, although it is slightly outside the scope of our discussion. The problem of Calais is what enables us to solve the issue of Calais. It's not the European law, but a treaty between two states in which France accepts the English border on its own territory with a number of measures and compensations. I've always found this a bit loopy, but at the moment, the UK is not in the Schengen area, and it solves its border problem in Calais through a solution or a treaty, which is a treaty between nations in terms of subsidiarity. So the European law for migration and asylum doesn't play any part here, and I wonder what will happen in the case of Brexit. Because it seems that nobody has discussed that so far, neither Europe nor the two parties concerned. What we see, to some extent, it's a wonderful demonstration. when there are problems in Greece or Sicily, they end up in Calais. This is what you call Europe. It shows something fantastic in a way. But the second problem, well, I think the French and the British government should discuss that. Right now, I don't see... Well, I don't know if Brexit has an impact on the treaty of the 2K. The answer is no, I don't think so. But from a legal point of view, it's a very complicated situation because we implement some of the Dublin rules in relation to the UK. Well, you see the complexity. The second problem is that of free movement of people and goods and services. Well, do we reinstate the border? This is the whole debate. The English or the British have to discuss whether or not to remain members of the customs union, and if not, what will be the situation. I think they gave up the idea that they thought about for a time, trying to find a miracle to be outside the customs union but benefit from all the union's advantages. I think it's a very tricky situation for the English. Europe is just waiting. We don't make the decision, the English do. But we've seen that the consequences would be quite damaging for our coasts, despite perhaps the fact that there will be free tax on ferries. But anyway, it will be difficult for us and for the UK. Look at the terminals in Dover, for example, and you will see that in terms of volume and territory, they have the capabilities to deal with that. Well, it's a very complicated issue, and it's being discussed at the moment. But what worries me most, I'll say it simply, it's the fact that the English are so lost. They're at a loss. They don't know what to do, which is very unusual for the British people. And they're very divided on that, but they just don't know what to do. But there are a number of consequences for our region. That's clear. And Europe is considering, for its new budget, is considering specific measures on the regional funds for the regions that will suffer or pay the worst price because of Brexit. Well, this is exactly the point I wanted to discuss with Dominique, because here on this at this table, we have three regions that are particularly impacted by Brexit. I represent the Committee of Regions, and in the committee, we've set up a sort of intergroup with the elected officials of all the regions that are the most directly concerned by that. That is, in think about the Irish and their complete disarray. And it's particularly striking when you go to the Irish border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. We were there with Carla Inslingberg some days ago, and you see the unemployment curve, for example, of the Newry town, which is right on the border, but on the Northern Ireland side. In the 70s, unemployment was at 30%, and then in 86, 93, 2003, these are important days for the European integration, and every time unemployment was going down. Today, we are down to 2% unemployment, 2%. And of course, the question is, this is a border. Nobody knows what will happen to this border. What will happen to the unemployment sort of curve. There are a number of legal issues, but I think there are a number of political issues as well. And I'm not quite happy with the multi-annual financial framework that is being proposed with the cohesion policy, because I think it's not clearly stated here. We had a meeting in Sofia last week with the COTA committee, and the representative of the commission was there to explain the future of the cohesion policy. But I think that there's one specific tool that should be proposed to help the regional funds in the border regions. Whilst in 2004, Michel Barnier had put in place a specific instrument to help the areas that was around a border that was about to be opened. That was for the Austrian lenders. And there were a sort of external border becoming an internal border. And they had a specific tool that had been designed and created for them with a priority channel for access to regional funds. And I think it is our political responsibility to have something similar. I'm not saying that the regional policy doesn't have, it has a CRITER, which is a good tool, and it says that when an internal border becomes an external border, it raises the issue of the four freedoms and therefore the issue of, is the European project any interest to anyone? And I think we've forgotten the political responsibility of the situation.
We still have a last important speaker, so I propose that we just take a few remarks out of the room and then we go on to our final chapter. So who wants to intervene? Let's take two, three people, not more, otherwise we run completely out of our time schedule.
Oui, alors, compte tenu, effectivement, de...
Indeed, given the time, I'll be very brief. Sorry to ask a rather technical question after the one you mentioned, Ms. Senator. And I want to apologize for that, but I can't help it. I can't resist the pleasure of asking this question to Mrs. Slingenberg. Sorry not to mispronounce your name. You talked about the transport package, but there's a challenge that should be stressed because it's a real problem for the single market, which is the alternative to road freight or transport. Let me take one example, that of France, from the Atlantic coast. On a north-south axis, 70% of vehicles on that particular motorway, the A10, are trucks. In other words, you have two or three individual cars. This is between Poitiers and Bordeaux. And lorries take this motorway because it's toll-free. Now, it has many consequences. First of all, a lot of accidents. And of course, a lot of pollution and fine particles on the area along the motorway. And in this transport package, are there strong initiatives to try to stop what has become a major problem, whilst at the same time, we have an important and long coast? So what about the combination of transport by sea and road, or railways, or by rail?
A little bit of time. We still have two persons who want to intervene, and then we can answer. Yeah. It's great.
I would like to take headphones.
Yeah. No, it's okay.
I think not too much people who understand Latvian language. Please take on. Vispirms paldies par šo.
First, thank you for this wonderful opportunity to speak about very topical issues. When we speak about EU and problems and challenges, mostly we receive many more questions in return. There are always more questions than answers, and it is one of the problems. I really liked what Dominic said at the beginning, that at least semantically we should have uniform understanding. It has to be understandable and clear, because we cannot solve problems, even attempt to solve problems, if we don't have uniform understanding about what is EU, what is Europe, what is cohesion, what is integration, what is migration policy. Because people speak about these things, but they have different understanding, different interpretation. I would like to ask two brief questions or provide two comments. For example, migration. Mr. Juncker, when he participated in the plenary of the Committee of Regions, he said, you know, we rich Europeans, we don't want to accept these poor migrants in Europe. Of course, we are more well off than the migrants who come to Europe. But then I want to ask, what about illegal border crossing? Isn't it a criminal offense? If we want to speak about how Europe should react, how European nations should react to migration, we cannot solve that if we ignore the causes of migration, if people try to avoid the consequences of war and they deserve support, or maybe there are other types of people who are armed and who come to Europe to commit acts of terror, then maybe it's criminal to allow these people to enter Europe to commit acts of terror. The next issue, cohesion policy. Currently, we have discussed the possibility of reducing financing for cohesion. But who of you can claim that those targets, objectives, purposes that we have had to solve under cohesion policy under Lisbon, which of them have been reached, at least partially? Because the gap between more and less developed countries has even increased. And who will be responsible? Who is responsible for the result of the cohesion policy? And who actually suffers? It's very difficult to explain to our voters, to our people, what actually is the achievement of Europe. Thank you.
Last intervention. Thank you.
Thank you. It's on? Yeah. Michiel Rijsberman, the province of Flevoland. I think one of the problems we did not discuss yet is, or maybe not strongly enough, is the rise of populism. 1.5 years ago, Trump was just elected, and we thought that maybe Marine Le Pen was going to do good in this country. In my country, we thought Geert Wilders was going to do good. Well, we got a different government in the Netherlands. Macron was a great success. I'm very happy that he is the president of France now. But we still have these governments in Poland, in Hungary. The populists won in Slovenia with help from the people from Orban. In Italy, we have a big crisis. I think if you take that into account, Europe might be in an existential crisis. I think we really need a way to solve that and to combat that. And if we do not find a way to handle these problems, I think we do not even have a European Union to deal with migration or the environment. So maybe the panel can respond to that pertinent problem.
Thank you. What I would ask from the panel is that we are very short, because otherwise our last and very important speaker is too late to get the floor. So let's be short and to the point. Thanks. Who wants to take the floor? Yeah.
Ladies first.
Ladies first.
I can maybe do the answer very briefly, peut-être en français. Je pense que c'est
maybe in French. I think it's a good example. I take the A10 motorway every summer to go on holiday in France. But I was talking about intermodal. We're trying to encourage changes in the means of transportation for road freight so that they go by rail or by sea. But this package includes incentives as well. So I think it's largely due to national policies, to the tax situation. And I think it's a good example. If we want to transition to a low-carbon economy, we have to make a number of decisions. And that has an impact on jobs. And that's why we have to look at it in France very carefully. If you're trying to reduce road freight, what does it mean? What sort of alternatives? What sort of impact on jobs? And start the discussion at a national, regional level. And we should also make sure that reduce the emissions, but also have proper transport. Thank you. I was also a director general for transport, but I speak under the control of Dominique Riquet. We tried, and we tried to have a package for railways to open the infrastructure to competition, hoping that the offering in a railway, a rail freight, would develop. We also worked on road tolls because that was quite tricky. But in fact, it's up to each member state to decide whether or not they want to charge for the use of roads. Now, it doesn't make you popular when you make such decisions, but it would influence the modal breakdown of different ways of transport. And of course, I'm directly concerned because I have a house in Bordeaux. May I very rapidly answer the question of our Latvian colleague? I fully agree with you. And this is linked to the issue of populism. If we can't convey the message and say that Europe is in control of migrations, then we'll fail. The control of migrations, without becoming Fortress Europe. Let me give you a figure. Do you know how many first-time residence permits we have given to third country nationals? 3.5 million for the whole of Europe, which shows that we need the students, the researchers, the workers. We need legal migrants. And we also have an obligation to protect them. And that's why we are working or suggesting to work with the High Commissioner for Refugees to take people from the refugee camps outside the European Union. But at the same time, we need to be very clear on our external borders, very clear on these borders. That is, you have three ways of going into a Europe. Either you're a European national, or you have a visa, or you come from a country that doesn't require a visa. And thirdly, on the external border, you ask for asylum. All the other cases have already been looked at, and they're part of the four or five pillars of our migration policy. that brings back to a return policy. And if we haven't communicated on that, we'll lose ground.
We only have 15 minutes left, and I would like to introduce the final speaker. So I would like to thank you very much for your interventions, and I would give them a big hand. Thank you. Of course, also, Madame la Sénatrice, very, very warmly thanked. And now I would like to introduce Pierre-Alexandre Anglade. Maybe he can join us here to speak about the final chapter of our, very interesting discussions, and it's about reshaping the political balance in the European Parliament. So Pierre-Alexandre Anglade is Vice President of the EU Affairs Committee in the French National Assembly. So I would like to give him the floor. Thanks, and welcome very much. Voilà. This is the pièce de résistance.
Merci.
Thank you. Thank you.
Je vais rester en hauteur. Mesdames et messieurs.
I can't seem to change the height of my seat. Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased and, of course, very honored to address you this morning in the Clemenceau room of the French Senate. As some of you may know, for 7 years I was a member of the European Parliament in the ALDE group. So, of course, I have a lot of friends and positive sentiments about the ALDE group, and pleased to speak to you about what may be happening over the next few months, because we find ourselves in a rather special political context. You've had a broad-ranging discussion on a number of subjects this morning, and the looming deadlines are very important for the project to reform Europe as being proposed by the President of France and a number of other European leaders. And the progressive Democrats are sort of need and are receiving a new breath, together with other parliamentarians who are in the National Assembly for the first time, like me. There are many of us. The European vision is a crucial plank in his electoral platform. In the past, European issues were left in the hands of the most extremist parties, often referred to today as populist parties, and the center-right and center-left parties that should have been involved in ambitious plans, an ambitious vision for Europe, but didn't do this for the very simple reason that they were profoundly divided on the subject. And when you're divided on a subject, you put the subject on the back burner, you don't debate it, and no progress is made. So for some 12, 13 years before Macron in France, when the two major French political families being divided on a number of other subjects, they simply set the European issue aside. And extremist parties like the Front National, the National Front, did in fact put European issues into their discourse. And Macron has really turned that around. He's put Europe at the heart of French political discourse. And if Europe is dysfunctional, it's because not enough attention is paid to European issues at national level. And that is no longer the case in France. And since then, our Europe has been buffeted by many crises. There was the French no, then the Dutch no, and then there was the Irish no, and there was the crisis of 2008, the war in Libya, the war in Syria, migration, the migration reception crisis. How many can we take in? What do we do with them? How do we turn them back? And the ultimate crisis, if you will, is Brexit, because it strikes at the very foundation of the European Union. Never before has a member state left. And in the last few years, a number of populist parties have come to the fore. But in some countries, like France, it's been possible to turn them aside and to have a pro-European grouping come to power. That's also been the case in the Netherlands. But then we recently saw what happened in the Italian elections. There was a very strong rejection of liberal democracy with guarantees for fundamental liberties and freedoms. There was a rejection of or opposition to equality between women and men, access to education, a free press, independent justice. I mean, the real pillars of European democracy as we have experienced it. And so it seems to us that the time has come to give a political answer to that situation, because if we don't do this, if we don't come together collectively, we may end up in 2019 with those forces, those negative forces, perhaps not in a majority, but in a very strong position, spread out into different political groups. And those whom one might refer to as progressive Democrats could hear their voice stifled. So we need to come together and to refuse to work together in order to safeguard certain partisan interests. Then, of course, you could undermine any effort of this kind. And what's at stake for 2019 must be to create a political alternative that would breathe new life into our European democracy as an ideal. We need to be able to show to Europeans that European democracy is an added value. And if we don't manage to do that, then in 5 years' time, people will be saying, you haven't managed to reform Europe, so let's set the whole European project aside. So what's at stake politically for 2019 is very clear. And those who believe in the reform agenda proposed by the President of France need to come together, I believe, and to move in a different direction to achieve transformation of the European Union by 2024. That is the objective of Macron's party, the so-called République en Marche, because the context that we're experiencing in Europe with this fascination for authoritarian regimes, this really is calling out for something else. And I think that people need to accept to do away with their old political habits, to stop any kind of backroom haggling, and to go beyond one's own political partisan interest and adopt a kind of open vision. This in the last legislature, what happened? There was Brexit. I mean, that is an extremely serious phenomenon. So in 2019, there must be a strong political response to events like that, to issues having to do with trade, migration, climate change. And one needs to be able to find that answer. So that's what I can say in a very unstructured way about this objective of reshaping the political balance in the European Parliament. But thank you for your attention, and of course I'll hear out your comments and questions if there are any.
Intervention, and I think we are still at the end of our meeting. I would like to conclude with three, I think for me, main ideas of today. The first idea is that we learned that there are a lot of challenges that only can be solved on a European level. We need Europe to answer those big challenges of today. Secondly, I think that we need to find a narrative, a response, that gives answers to people in their questions that really matter in their daily life. That's what we need. We need to find a program, an action program, that answers very concretely in the daily lives of people, that make a difference. And three, to do that, you need a strong, that's what you told us, a strong political force in 19 that brings together all those people who believe in Europe, who are pro-European, who want to reform, and who want to keep alive the dream that was built on for decades already in Europe. And that force consists out of liberals, democrats, radicals, people in the center, to build a very strong center force in Europe. Inspired by what Macron did in France. It can be a source of inspiration for the rest of Europe. And that's where we have to work on. And our challenge is to do that, to build that alliance. And that takes time, that takes energy, that takes also courage to do it, because if you stand on your own ground, you don't move, nothing will happen. But if we do it, it can be the most beautiful opportunity we can see, because we can change the political balance in Europe, because the conservatives are on the drift, socialists are in the are losing. So maybe it can be history we write next year. But we need each other to do that. So I thank you for being here. I thank you for attending the meeting. To your input was very interesting. Of course, I thank you for the final speech. And I hope we stay very closely together in regaining the future of Europe. Thank you.
Je peux juste vous demander.
Could I just ask you, please, because we need to leave this room in good condition for the next meeting this afternoon. It would be very helpful to us if you could take all your papers, pens. Please do not leave anything behind in the room.
Et les écouteurs, vous les laissez sur place.
And as for the headsets, please leave them on the seats, on the chairs, or at the very back of the room. For the headsets, on the chairs or at the back of the room.